There's a lot of homes that are getting cold, and businesses are closing down because they were depending on this fuel delivery.
Early freeze-up means no fuel for some YK Delta villages. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 20th of October. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, looking at ways to foster good communication between all Alaskans.
Even among Alaska Native groups, Southeast Natives may have different ways to communicate than, say, Inupiaq or Southwest Yupiks.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP. Giving back to community is a priority because they live here too.
Jurors in the trial of Senator Ted Stevens heard final testimony today. The last word was from Senator Stevens himself. Closing arguments will start tomorrow morning, with jury deliberation beginning on Wednesday. Stevens is charged with felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms about gifts, including the renovation of his Girdwood home. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, Stevens' testimony came down to what qualifies as a gift and how much he knew about the men working on his home remodeling project.
Senator Stevens kept his temper in check Monday as prosecutor Brenda Morris picked up where she left off last week, hammering Stevens about alleged gifts. The senator answered mostly with measured yes ma'ams, and although at times their back and forth was strained, both held their ground. Stevens told Morris that furniture his friend Bill Allen placed in the Stevens couple's Girdwood home wasn't a gift because they didn't want it. The senator said Allen actually stole the Stevens' furniture in the process. Morris asked Stevens why didn't he call the police, and the senator said he still might. Yet Allen's furniture sits in Stevens' house 8 years later. In 2005, Stevens wrote Allen an email asking if it was okay to pass along the furniture to Stevens' son Ben and his family who were moving into a larger house. In the email, Stevens also tries to get his own furniture back to no avail. Prosecutor Morris said it seems strange Ted Stevens would want to give his son furniture the senator and his wife described as old, big, and having cigarette burns. Ben Stevens never did get the Bill Allen chairs and black leather couches. Senator Stevens tried to explain another item. He told Morris he did not have to declare a $2,700 massage chair on his financial disclosure form because it was not a gift. In fact, Stevens said he refused to take it when a friend offered it as a gift. So how, Morris asked, did the chair end up at Stevens' Washington home 7 years ago, and why is it still there? Stevens said it's a loan and sits in his basement, rarely used. He said, in fact, he and his wife have a lot of items in their house that don't belong to them, prompting raised eyebrows from Morris. The prosecutor moved on to invoices and brought up a bill that the government made much of during its case. When Stevens' boiler broke in January 2006, he paid for the materials to fix it, but Bill Allen paid the labor costs. Stevens said when he found out what Allen did, he tried to correct the situation by contacting Allen and another friend to intervene and get a bill. He never did. But Morris said if Stevens really wanted to pay, he could have contacted the repairman directly. Stevens replied, "Yes, I could have." Morris said, "But you didn't." And Stevens agreed, quote, "No, I did not." Morris also guided Stevens through a series of emails Monday in which he talks about VECO employees working on the Girdwood house. Some of the VECO employees testified earlier in the trial that they were paid by the company to work on the house. Stevens maintains he thought his wife was paying them separately from their VECO jobs, and Stevens insisted there's a difference between VECO and his friend, CEO Bill Allen. Stevens said one is a corporation, while the other is human. Brenda Morris asked if that meant Stevens thought he didn't have to disclose gifts from a person. Stevens replied that, quote, "This has nothing to do with disclosure, ma'am." But Morris says the case has everything to do with disclosures, and her team will try to prove that to jurors Tuesday morning during closing arguments. Then it's the defense team's turn to show their version of the story, that the Honorable Senator Ted Stevens did nothing wrong. The prosecution will have the final word Tuesday afternoon, and then jury deliberation will start on Wednesday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Two villages were caught with empty fuel tanks when the Kuskokwim River froze up last weekend. Fuel storage tanks along the river are typically filled up in late fall so that communities have gas and heating fuel for the winter. But Napuskiuk and Kwithluk are starting the season running on empty. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more from Bethel.
The lower Kuskokwim began freezing up last weekend. Many residents expected some kind of intermittent thaw, but winter conditions have prevailed without a break. George Guy is the business administrator for Queethluck Incorporated. With temperatures dropping, he says the situation there is dire.
We're in a super crisis as we speak.
Queethluck is the closest village upriver of Bethel, where hundreds of thousands of gallons of fuel is stored. Guy says he made an emergency call to Bethel distributor Top Fuel. He requested they barge up whatever fuel they could. Guy says Top gave it their best shot.
But they encountered a three-mile stretch of packed ice, so they had to divert back to Bethel.
Downriver of Bethel, and even closer to the fuel tanks, lies the village of Nebuskiak. Residents there are in the same situation. Philip Nikolai is the general manager at Nebuskiak's corporation store. He says their distributor, Crowley Fuel, waited until freeze-up began to make the short trip over to his village.
They just finally tried to deliver some fuel on Monday or Tuesday, and by that time the ice was too thick.
Nikolai says Nebuskiak has enough fuel for about a month's worth of electricity, and they are already limiting the amount of gas and heating fuel customers can buy.
There's a lot of homes that are getting cold, and businesses are closing down because they were depending on this fuel delivery.
Crowley Fuel says part of the problem was low water levels earlier this summer. That's the time of year they send their barges far upriver. There, they try to top off their storage farm in McGrath. But Crowley's Walt Keg says when their barges got there, water levels were too low. So they waited.
You know, we tried for a while, hoping for water to come back, rain or some other glacial melt, but it was kind of a cool season, and I just don't think we got the water we needed all season long.
Those barges never made it to McGrath, affecting surrounding villages that rely on that fuel. The wait also pushed back the entire fall delivery schedule. Crowley filled up other upriver communities and then the tundra villages located on a Kuskokwim tributary. When freeze-up began, Queethluck and Nebuskiak were out of time. In Queethluck, Guy says they try to start their winter with 170,000 gallons of fuel in their tanks. With less than 1% of that on hand, Guy says his community is in the worst fuel situation he can remember.
This is the first time in our village history that we have to fly in fuel.
Queethluck has made an emergency purchase of 10,000 gallons of heating fuel from the lower Kuskokwim School District. Guy says that will be enough for 10 days of power generation and will allow customers to buy about 2 weeks' worth of heating fuel. Queethluck has also arranged for airborne deliveries, but Guy says paying for that will add to already record-breaking prices. Unleaded gas is selling for $5.86 a gallon. Heating fuel is selling at $8.10 a gallon. Queethluck has contacted several government agencies, including the governor's office and the Department of Homeland Security. They are attempting to have the situation declared a disaster in order to free up federal funding. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Southeast Native organization highlights the plight of rural communities.
The message from the rural communities were, we don't need a five-year solution. We need a solution now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska.
The annual Alaska Federation of Natives Convention gets underway this week in Anchorage, and as in years past, the Elders and Youth Conference leads off the gathering with discussions and workshops taking place today and tomorrow. Willie Hensley is chairman of the First Alaskans Institute. The Institute organizes the Elders and Youth Gathering for AFN. Hensley says there is a very full agenda, and the day started off well.
With opening presentations by Bobby Quinteville, who is president of ASRC, and of course Dr. Zobelev, who is turning, I think, 100 this year. from Southeast Alaska.
And what are some of the big issues that elders and youth are going to be focusing on at their portion of the conference this year?
Well, first of all, the youth are very, very much involved in the development of the program. And so they have been very visible in presenting their retrospective of the 25 years since the first Youth Council met at the AFN. So we had Valerie Davidson, who was the moderator from that first conference back when, and now she is, of course, an attorney working in the healthcare world. So they had also a presentation by an elder as well from Southeast Alaska who is a weaver. And so it is what we had always envisioned, a communication back and forth between the elders and the... And needless to say, there are many issues, issues relating to retention of identity and language, also of financial stresses that are taking place in villages because of energy costs, and of course the migration issue that's taking place between the villages and the urban areas.
And this is the first big convention that the new Dena'ina Convention Center is hosting. How's the turnout so far?
Oh, it's really awesome, and the facility is just unbelievably great. It's just it's very, very easy to get around, but you also have a way to get out to get some fresh air. And there's places for coffee and places to chit-chat with your friends, and the sound is very good. So it's really a wonderful place.
Willie Hensley is the chairman of the First Alaskans Institute. The main AFN convention begins on Thursday. Last week's listing of the Cook Inlet beluga whale as an endangered species is bound to have repercussions for some large construction projects still on the horizon. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
One such proposal is the Chewitna coal mine across from Anchorage on the west side of the inlet. So far, there have been no state or federal permits issued for the Chewitna mine. Mike Frank is an attorney with the Trustees for Alaska in Anchorage. He says that under the endangered listing, new unpermitted projects will have to undergo a consulting requirement in which federal agencies contemplating granting a permit or license will have to first clear it with the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Whenever they have a pending permit application, they'll be obligated to consult with the National Marine Fisheries Service to make sure that the proposed action will not jeopardize the continued existence of the Cook Inlet beluga whale. And the National Marine Fisheries Service during this consultation process will determine whether or not the proposed federal action will have an adverse impact and can, if it finds that to be the case, propose reasonable and prudent alternatives such that if those are adopted, the project could move forward.
The Environmental Protection Agency is reviewing the plan for the Chewitna mine, although no final determination has been made on the project. Frank says the fact that a species is listed is no guarantee that a development project won't go forward.
It's very, very rarely occurs when a project is stopped because there is no feasible or prudent alternative or mitigation measure that will ensure that the project will not adversely affect the particular endangered species.
Bob Shavelson heads the Cook Inlet Keeper. He says he's heartened that science prevailed over politics in the matter of the beluga. Shavelson says the listing could impact existing infrastructure.
The Anchorage wastewater facility is one of a handful of facilities across the country that's gotten a waiver under the Clean Water Act to only partially treat its waste. So we get, tens of millions of gallons of partially treated waste are discharged into Upper Cook Inlet every day.
Shavelson says if science is applied to a project to protect the endangered animal, there is no reason that a listing will stand in the way of development. But some projects, like the Port of Anchorage expansion, are questionable, he says.
This project would fill in 135 acres of prime beluga whale habitat. Everybody recognizes the importance of the Port of Anchorage, but they haven't been able to answer two questions. What is the need for an expansion of this size, and how are you going to pay for it? And in light of the economic uncertainty that's gripping the country right now, it's important to recognize that this project did not go through any type of vigorous permitting, and that every major federal agency, the EPA, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, object to the issuance of this permit.
Cook Inlet Keeper is suing the EPA over a clean water permit issued to Cook Inlet oil and gas developers in 2007. That suit has yet to be argued in court. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Southeast Alaska's oldest Native organizations will focus on energy, economic development, and health care over the next year. The Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood held their Grant Camp Convention earlier this month in Ketchikan. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld spoke with the group's leaders and filed this report.
Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood camps often come to the aid of people in need in their home communities. ANS Grand President Johanna Dibdahl of Hoonah says that's getting harder and harder.
One of the things that the Alaska Native Sisterhood used to do was to provide 50 gallons of emergency fuel if somebody ran out and didn't have the finances to get it. But, you know, 50 gallons of fuel now is, you know, several hundred dollars. We have to, I think, explore, you know, all of the other avenues for home heating and making sure that our houses have insulation and windows that, you know, are properly insulated.
Dibdahl was just elected to her fifth term as the Sisterhood's regional president. She says the organization is committed to pushing even harder for solutions to energy problems, which tie into Southeast's general economic downturn. So is the ANB, says Bradley Flitch of Juneau, the group's newly elected regional grand president.
The message from the rural communities were, we don't need a five-year solution. We need a solution now. And so right now, the immediate issue is the high cost of energy in rural Alaska. And how do we get those rural communities off diesel? Or how do we bring the cost of diesel down?
Flitch and Dibdahl say they'll push for expanding the regional power grid. They look forward to planned lines from Petersburg to Cake and from Admiralty Island to Hoonah. And they're interested in pursuing other options for lowering energy costs, which could help Southeast's economy recover. Both say the region's oldest Native organizations need to cooperate more, and they need to team up with other Southeast groups, including government, tribal, and nonprofit organizations. Dibdahl says that includes efforts to promote health. The groups have established a focus on diabetes prevention and treatment, and there's a long-time desire for a regional cancer treatment center, which Dibdahl says needs wider support.
I think that some of the barriers are just our inability to get everybody on the same page and moving forward. I think that, you know, we tend to isolate ourselves from the other organizations, I think, that can help us. And I think we need to be innovative in our thinking and, you know, offer some solutions as well as asking for assistance.
The Grand Camp Convention in Ketchikan attracted about 100 delegates from around 30 camps, the term for local chapters. The event celebrated the decades of service by longtime member Walter Sobolev, who turns 100 this year. Those attending also heard from tribal leaders, elected officials, and candidates for Congress and the state legislature. Flitch and Dibdahl pledged to expand the group's membership. Both say that includes improved communications.
We're spanning five generations. From Dr. Sobolev celebrating his 100th birthday and the internet age and instant communications through Blackberries and texting and trying to get all the communications and so that we're all up to speed is the challenge.
Flitch has already set up a website called ANBTV, which features recordings of speeches and oral history. He hopes to expand the effort.
One of the ways of doing this is putting our young people and elders together with video cameras and the internet. And that way, the elders are getting the information as well as they're teaching our young people. And our young people are developing employment skills for the 21st century.
Next year's Grand Camp Convention will take place in the capital city. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, a proud supporter of cultural activities that enrich the lives of all Alaskans. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
A campaign was launched today in Washington to get a bigger share of the federal transportation budget for what's called active transportation, walking and bicycling. The Rails to Trails Conservancy put out a report saying that modest increases in these activities would lead to an annual reduction of 70 billion miles of driving. The report lists a number of case studies, and one of them involves the urbanized areas of South Central Alaska. It was largely written by Lois Epstein of the Alaska Transportation Priorities Project.
We are one of many places around the country, there are several dozen, that are together asking for more federal money for walking and bicycling.
Epstein says planning for safer, better lit, and properly designed bicycle and walking routes is already well along in Anchorage and is now underway in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough as well.
The idea is to make bicycling and walking as safe and convenient as possible for people in urbanized parts of Alaska, like Anchorage or Palmer and Wasilla and the area in between the two communities.
Along with local governments, the South Central Foundation has signed on to the Alaska Active Transportation Campaign because of the health benefits of more exercise. The foundation would like to see an advertising campaign that promotes bicycling and walking for Native families. Epstein says active transportation has been on the increase in Anchorage for some time now, and the city has done enough things to make it safer that the rate of accidents involving vehicles and pedestrians has been stable since 1984. The national organization got funding for the study from the advocacy group Bikes Belong. It calls active transportation the missing piece of the transportation policy puzzle, especially in a time of rising fuel prices.
We want to see the discussion move towards not just better roads and bridges, which are good things, but also shifting people's transportation patterns so that they find it easier to make their trips via bicycling or walking.
The report says already active transportation is more than marginal. About 10% of all trips in America are taken by bicycle or on foot. Just because we use the same language doesn't mean we speak the same way. Sometimes the speaking style of different ethnic groups, especially Native and non-Native, blocks effective communication. KSKA's Len Anderson reports about an effort to reduce these conversational misunderstandings.
Lauren Anderson supervises public programming at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. The position demands that he teach several Alaska Native cultural awareness classes. That's precisely what he's doing for the Municipality of Anchorage and the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation before the beginning of this year's annual Alaska Federation of Natives Conference. Anderson has three different pre-AFN work sessions. One describes the various Alaska Native groups. Another focuses on government relationships. The third takes up inter-ethnic communication. The communication topic, which repeats this week, drew several people to the eighth floor of City Hall last Friday afternoon. Anderson's family is from Kodiak and Afognak Islands, but he also grew up in Washington State. The varied geographical backgrounds of his youth helped make him aware of communication differences.
Not everybody communicates in the same fashion, and that there's a lot of facets to communication.
Anderson noted those facets often get in the way when natives and non-natives converse. He used conversational pitch to provide one example.
Now, if a boss comes to you and asks you, do you love your job? And asks two people, let's say one from the Western culture, one from the Native culture. The one from the Native culture says, yes, I love my job. And then the other person says, I love my job. Who's telling the truth?
Probably both. But most English speakers, responding to the pitch of the responses, would think the excitement of the non-native indicated a happier worker. That's not so, says Anderson, given the basic pitch restraint of native conversation. But such responses can play a role in promotion and pay. Another facet is tempo, both in quickness of response and sentence speed. Natives will often speak at a slower pace than mainstream English speakers. Anderson says sometimes coastal speech can be slower due to natural environment than that of inland natives. Tempo and pitch are just two elements that can cause false appraisals between the two cultures. According to AEDC Communications Director Heather Cavanaugh, the workshops on Native culture were first offered when AFN returned to Anchorage after moving the previous year to Fairbanks.
When AFN came to Anchorage 2 years ago, we felt it was very important to try to educate and help the business community understand Alaska Natives and rural Alaska, especially as we were welcoming them and wanted to welcome a lot of Alaska Natives from rural Alaska to Anchorage.
In 2007, AFN and its up to 3,000 delegates and attendees went back to Fairbanks. This year, they've returned to Anchorage and are the first large gathering to use the entire newly opened Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center. The municipality's Rural Affairs Coordinator, Amy Spark-Dobmeyer, says Anchorage's welcome seeks to duplicate what the AFN attendees experience in Fairbanks.
Fairbanks looked at every aspect of what it means to welcome AFN to their community. Their residents really stepped up and thought, what would make it pleasant for them to be here? So they had their Golden Heart greeters at the airport throughout town. You didn't even have to wear a button to be a greeter. There were people who lived in Fairbanks who just approached people and wanted their stay to be good and safe and fun.
Part of providing that pleasant stay is being able to talk to one another.
What we hope to do with offering these sessions is at least give the attendees some understanding of different communication styles, even among Alaska Native groups in Alaska. Southeast Natives may have different ways to just be and communicate than, say, Inupiaq or Southwest Yupiks.
Dobmeyer herself has family and linguistic ties to the Chupik village of Chivak in southwest Alaska. Anderson's hour-long inter-ethnic communication workshop is based on a two-day, 16-hour class he conducts at the Alaska Native Heritage Center as part of its cultural awareness program. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
In celebration of Alaska's 50th anniversary of statehood, the Governor's Legacy Dinner will be held on November 14th at the Hotel Captain Cook. All eight of the living governors of Alaska will be in attendance for this elegant and prestigious event. Enjoy world-class entertainment, gourmet dining, and special anniversary gifts. For more information and to make your reservation to the Alaska Governor's Legacy Dinner, log on to AlaskaTurns50.com. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Statehood Celebration Committee.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.